This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley, editor of TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Today, we're looking back on 2014 with our critics. We'll start with David Edelstein, who spoke with Terry last week about the year in film.
Hi, David. It's good to talk with you again.
Hi, Terry. Happy holidays.
And to you. So let's start with your 10 best list. What order would you like to read it to us in?
Well, I'll read my list from 1 to 11. Yes, it's 11 this year, with one counted sentence about each movie, but I'm going to put the docs at the end because it's easier to wrap my head around it. Number one, gee, this is inevitable, and it is Richard Linklater's Boyhood, which I think catches the passing of time like no other movie because it's literal. Then comes Selma, which is Ava DuVernay's epic in which Martin Luther King, played by the great David Oyelowo, meets LBJ. Number three is The Babadook, the Australian director Jennifer Kent's phenomenally scary pop-out storybook of a movie. Number four is Whiplash, Damien Chazelle's drama of jazz and abuse. Jim Jarmusch's Only Lovers Left Alive, where vampires Tilda Swinton and Tom Hiddleston are deadpan undead hipsters in a dying world. Mr. Turner is number six, you know that. Mike Leigh's marvelous JMW Turner biopic with that great grunter Timothy Spall adding a dollop of the grotesque. 2 Days, One Night is the Belgian Dardenne brothers' latest triumph with Marion Cotillard as a desperate woman begging co-workers to forego a big bonus so she can keep her job. And Marion Cotillard is also the best thing about my last fiction film. She's a young Polish woman in James Gray's moody period drama, The Immigrant. Now, those are eight. Let's go to the docs. Not a lot of people have seen Nick Broomfield's Tales of the Grim Sleeper, which will come to HBO in 2015. It is an incendiary look at a South Central Los Angeles serial killer who murdered as many as 100 women, and Broomfield finds out more about the case in a few weeks than the LAPD did in 25 years. Number 10, Citizen 4, which is Laura Poitras's avant-garde paranoid conspiracy thriller that just happens to be the real story of Edward Snowden and a technological infrastructure that can monitor everyone in the world. And my last doc is also little seen. It's called The Overnighters, in which director Jesse Moss tells the story of a North Dakota pastor who provides shelter for economically desperate temp workers and discovers that no good deed goes unpunished.
So tell us more about why Boyhood is number one on your 10 best list this year.
You know, there are all sorts of ways on film to denote the passing of time. And Richard Linklater has done that by setting a lot of films in real time and using time as a kind of marker, you know, before midnight, before dawn, before lunch, before brunch. I don't remember even the names of the movies. But, you know, time is really important to him. And here, when he follows over 12 years, this one boy aging, we get to see the changes on a kind of molecular level. We get to feel the passing of time. And since the movie is about things that are lost, that can't be recovered, you can't go back in time. Once you see him age, it's as if you can't bring the little boy back. That, you know, you can't, you know how actors in movies are usually, they have a little boy playing the character at a young age, and then they have a middle one, and then they have the grown-up. You can't bring the little boy back. This guy is aging before your eyes. And that, to me, makes the movie so poignant and so profound. It gives a kind of documentary element, but it transcends documentary.
So Selma is number two on your list. What makes it stand out as a historical movie? Because historical movies often get history wrong in their attempt to make the movie concise and to fit the arc of a dramatic film rather than be as messy as actual history is.
Well, I'm not necessarily sure this film doesn't make many of those same mistakes. It certainly condenses. It certainly takes a lot of shortcuts. What I love about it is that it focuses as much on the politics as it does on the idealism. I mean, Martin Luther King had a dream, but that dream wouldn't have mattered if he couldn't organize people and if he wasn't able to convert people, among them Lyndon Baines Johnson, to his cause. What I think is most fascinating about this movie are the scenes in which he's opposite LBJ in the Oval Office. And LBJ, you know, if you've read Robert Caro and you've listened to those crazy Oval Office tapes of LBJ, he wasn't a visionary speaker. He was a sort of Texas backroom wheeler dealer. And he had an agenda here. His agenda was to pass the Great Society legislation. He didn't want to come down. He didn't want to use up all his chips on the civil rights fight. And it was Martin Luther King who, by talking to him and also by his actions and Selma, got him finally to go on national television and say what no president had ever said or maybe has said since then, which is, "We shall overcome." What a moment. What a moment in this movie.
David, what do you think were some of the best performances of the year?
Well, I want to mention a film that's going to loom very large at the Academy Awards, which, by the way, I hate, but I feel like I have to acknowledge. Julianne Moore gives a performance in a film called Still Alice. She plays the victim of early onset Alzheimer's disease. She's 50 when the diagnosis comes in. She is a professor at, well, it was Harvard in the novel, it's Columbia in the movie. Julianne Moore gives an extraordinary performance. She plays a character who's always defined herself by her intellect. And so for most, if not all, the movie, you're just riveted on her face. You're just watching her think. And as there's more and more distance between her thinking the thought and being able to articulate it, being able to chase it down, it becomes heartbreaking in a kind of visceral way that I've really never seen in that kind of movie. She's marvelous at evoking the distance between Alice's brain and tongue.
Any other performances you want to single out?
The other major performance of the year is by David Oyelowo as Martin Luther King. How do you play Martin Luther King convincingly? Well, for one thing, he's a British trained actor. He's got this marvelous voice. And when you can take Martin Luther King's words, many of which we know already, and you can make it sound like they're coming out of your head, and more important, your diaphragm, then you've gone a long way. He is a spectacular actor. And the performance, too, the way Martin Luther King is characterized in the film, he's very much a public figure. And a public figure is someone who, every utterance, he is sort of carrying the weight of millions of people on his back. But he's also a man who, as we know, had some private quirks, some of which were exploited by J. Edgar Hoover, who tried to blackmail King. And there's something very moving about the way that David Oyelowo makes it clear that Martin Luther King can't reconcile the public and private man. He can't do it. It's like he doesn't have the emotional equipment. That gives him an astounding vulnerability that I've never seen in that kind of portrait.
Well, what would you recommend that we see over Christmas?
Well, it's let's talk about all the major Christmas releases, because I think they're all significant. Into the Woods is an extraordinary case, because look, early in the movie, I was jumping out of my seat. I was so happy. We know it's the Stephen Sondheim and James Lapine musical, which farcically mixes up a bunch of Brothers Grimm fairy tales. And they wrote it. They've said they wrote it to explode the sugary Walt Disney treatment of fairy tales. And here it is, opening on Christmas Day, a big budget Disney movie and working amazingly well. You've got Meryl Streep as the witch, and she's really fun. And Anna Kendrick as Cinderella, and she has a gorgeous soprano. You've got Chris Pine as a prince and Johnny Depp, the big bad wolf. And James Corden, who you know is going on after Colbert on CBS. My favorite is Emily Blunt, who's dizzy and blurty and funny. But as most people know, the musical takes a turn into the apocalyptic in the second half, really the last third. And man, it doesn't work in this context. I mean, I didn't much care for it when I saw the show on Broadway in 1987, but I respected it. But in a Disney movie opening Christmas Day and pitch to the whole family this sudden wave of awful things. So I say, see it. I say, leave it. What's clearly the end of Act One. I'm actually not being facetious. You get all the enchantment and even some of the ambiguities and the portents of doom, but you won't come out thinking that the big bad wolf had directed the ending.
Mm. Well, you know, a movie that's opening for Christmas that is not exactly a joyous film, though I suppose in the end it's uplifting, is Unbroken, which is about, it's based on the true story of someone who was a prisoner of war during World War II in Japan. What'd you think?
It's a good movie. Most people know it's about Olympic runner Louis Zamperini.
And that it's based on a book by Lauren Hillenbrand.
Yes, a book that actually in some ways was more difficult to take than the movie. I mean, if you read it, those final chapters in which this poor guy gets broken in every way imaginable. I mean, Angelina Jolie is actually a lot more discreet and tasteful than the descriptions in that book. It's a very, very good film. It's very well made. It's enraging. I'm not sure, though, that Jolie's making the principal Japanese torturer sexually ambiguous. I mean, he almost looks like a cross-dresser, is a great idea. It adds this really kind of peculiar psychosexual element to the whole thing that I found disturbing and even offensive.
Have you seen Big Eyes yet, and would you recommend that for Christmas?
Yeah, I really like Big Eyes. Most people know it's Tim Burton's story of Margaret Keane, who painted all those round-eyed waifs that her husband Walter took credit for. It's not the usual Tim Burton style, but Burton has always loved the purveyors of kitsch if he thinks that their work reveals some interesting, strange mind. I mean, that's why he loved Ed Wood. I mean, he genuinely loved Ed Wood. And he got together with the same screenwriters to do this one. And it's a much straighter film, a much more earnest film. But Amy Adams gives a really lovely, vulnerable performance. I thought Christoph Waltz as Walter was too cartoonish. He's very broad, so that Adams has to make Margaret Keane stupider than she needs to be taken in. But the last part of the film is so cool. It's like this suburban noir in which Margaret is trapped in her own world of big eyes, which suddenly look as if everybody in the movie is catatonic with terror. It's really, really fun. I do recommend the film.
So, David, on the whole, would you say that this was like a good year for film?
No, I would say this is a very, very depressing year for film because none of the great material came from Hollywood studios. We know in this era in which potentially 1,000 films may be released in this country every year that you're going to get some great movies. But it would be really nice if every so often you got one from a major studio rather than what's happening now with the studios directing so much of their financial resources into these sequels and comic book movies and movies that really leave very little room for creative expression and for doing something weird and potentially boundary moving.
So David, you basically told us that this year you've kind of like written off the major studios. You're not looking to them to make good movies because they're doing, you know, spin-offs and big budget blockbusters. But what about the indie films? There's no shortage of indie films. How is this year for indie films?
This year was a wonderful year for indie films. I mean, I actually consider Selma an indie film. I consider The Babadook an indie film. I consider Whiplash an indie film, even though they were released by major studio, in some cases the smaller divisions. It's a terrific year. Look, kids are coming out of film schools. The cost of making a movie has plummeted in terms of your equipment. You can always find a lot of out-of-work actors. You know, people are creating really meaningful movies from nothing. It's just the gap has been widening every year between indies and studio pictures, and it has never been wider.
Well, David, thanks for talking with us about the year in film. I wish you a happy new year. And
it's my pleasure,
holidays.
Terry. I wish you a great holiday. I hope you catch up with everything you haven't seen. And thank you so much.
David Edelstein spoke with Terry last week and is film critic for New York Magazine. We'll hear from more of our critics after a break. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to our year in review. Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, has put together her picks for the best books of the year. Here's her list.
For this year's Best Books of the Year list, I reject the tyranny of the decimal system. Some years, it's more than 10. Here, then, are my top 12 books of 2014. The Department of Speculation by Jenny Offel is a slim novel whose lingering after effects belie its size. It follows a young woman as she haltingly moves through marriage and a motherhood rattled by colic, only to be slammed to a full stop by her husband's infidelity. Offel's departures from traditional form make this old story feel painfully fresh again. For instance, a chapter entitled, "How Are You?" is followed by these two words repeated by our betrayed heroine for a page and a half. So scared, so scared, so scared, so scared. Brian Morton also experiments with form in his witty and affecting short novel, Florence Gordon, about a 75-year-old icon of the second-wave women's movement who's cranky enough to walk out on her own surprise birthday party just because she wants to get back to writing her memoirs. Humor is also a big selling point of Julie Schumacher's Dear Committee Members. This epistolary novel is composed of a year's worth of recommendation letters written by a weary professor. The gem of a law school recommendation letter this professor writes for a cutthroat undergrad whom he's known for all of 11 minutes is alone worth the price of Schumacher's smart and ultimately moving book. One more novel that upends conventional form is Ben Lerner's 1004, a language-drunk tale of a young writer in New York, which he calls The Sinking City. That's because 1004 is bookended by two historic hurricanes that threaten New York, Hurricane Irene and Hurricane Sandy. Sandy also looms large in the four wry and melancholy stories in Richard Ford's Let Me Be Frank With You, which mark the return of his New Jersey everyman hero, Frank Bascom. Ron Rash's beautiful short story collection, Something Rich and Strange, focuses on every man and every woman figures in Appalachia. These stories roam from the Civil War through the Great Depression and into a present where moonshine stills have been replaced by homegrown meth labs. Even though it takes place in France and Germany during the harsh rigors of World War II, Anthony Doerr's magical adventure novel, All the Light We Cannot See, is far, far away from the stripped-down realities of Rash's world. A blind French girl and her father become the hapless custodians of the Sea of Flames, a rare diamond that Hitler desires for his treasure trove. Doerr refers to the work of Jules Verne and Alexandre Dumas, and his own sweeping plot and sumptuous language place Doerr in the same category as those master storytellers. Sarah Waters spins a pretty wild yarn herself in The Paying Guests, an eerie tale of a genteel mother and daughter forced to take in lodgers after World War I. Eerie is also the word for Tana French's mystery, The Secret Place, the fifth in her superb Dublin Murder Squad series. The Secret Place pries open the hermetically sealed world of a girls' prep school and lets readers peer into the toxic stew of hormones and homicidal rivalries roiling within. Now on to nonfiction. Roz Chass' Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant is a brilliant graphic memoir of Chass' own adventures in caring for her two elderly parents. Chaste captures the whole magilla of elder care, from the exhaustion and looniness of clearing out her parents' Brooklyn apartment, stuffed with old bank books and toasters, to the final moments of their lives. Hector Tobar's triumph of a tale of extreme endurance, Deep Down Dark, recounts the ordeal of the 33 Chilean miners buried alive for 69 days under a mountain of fallen rock. And finally, here's my nominee for Book of the Year. It's a work of nonfiction, even though I think this was a stronger year for fiction. Greg Grandin's The Empire of Necessity describes the real-life slave revolt in 1805 on a ship called the Trial, anchored off the coast of Chile. That revolt inspired Herman Melville's 1855 floating Gothic masterpiece of a short novel, Benito Cereno. In Grandin's previous book, the much-acclaimed Fordlandia, he chronicled how Henry Ford tried to establish a utopian version of small-town America in the middle of the Brazilian rainforest. In The Empire of Necessity, Grandin takes readers on a tour of the hell of the slave trade in the Americas. I read The Empire of Necessity way back in January, and it's haunted me ever since. In fact, all of these disparate books on my Best of the Year list contain characters, scenes, or voices that linger long past the last page of their stories.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. You'll find her Best Books of the Year list on our website, freshair.npr.org. Our rock critic, Ken Tucker, has his year-end top 10 list, as well as some thoughts about music trends that emerged this year.
Spoon and its lead vocalist, Britt Daniel, making the kind of indie pop music that pleases folks like me, and maybe you, who love its simultaneous sense of history as well as its forward momentum. Spoon's album, They Want My Soul, was all sustained pleasure. And pop music on a bigger scale is the triumph of 2014. Grand, glossy music making overtook hip-hop, country, and rock, or, more accurately, found new ways to absorb them, to dominate the airwaves, the charts, and our consciousness. This was, after all, the year of Pharrell's Happy, an immediately ubiquitous tune that became an anthem for thoughtful optimism as well as the go-to music for what seemed like every light interlude in a TV sitcom. And what was even poppier than Pharrell's pop? Taylor Swift's pop, of course.
My next mistake, love's a game, wanna play. New money, suit and tie, I can read you like a magazine. Ain't it funny, rumors fly, and I know you heard about me. So hey, let's be friends, I'm dying to see how this one ends. Grab your passport and my hand, I can make the bad guys good for a weekend. So it's gonna be forever, or it's gonna go down in flames. You can tell me when it's over, if the high was worth the pain. Got a long list of ex-lovers, they'll tell you I'm insane. Cause you know I love the players, and you love the game. Cause we're young and
this was the year Taylor Swift severed her remaining ties to country music to make her gleefully bold album 1989, which did what few albums do anymore: present itself as a carefully sequenced collection of songs designed to be listened to from first cut to last. You know, the way Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band was. The opposite of bright, catchy pop is represented on a couple of other albums on my best list. The assiduously ornery band Pear Ubu makes music that is at once harsh and noisy, morosely serious and playfully nimble, and I love the band's album Carnival of Souls. Even moodier is the music of Lana Del Rey, whom you might call the anti-Taylor Swift. On her album Ultraviolence, Del Rey stretches out syllables and song lengths so that every tune becomes a siren call, beckoning you toward her.
Easter comedian lasted for deadly nightshade, 'cause I was filled with poison but blessed with beauty and rage. Jen told me
no album seemed as rich and deep with complexities about family, time, and geography as Roseanne Cash's The River and the Thread. It's a tour through an area of the South that has meant a lot to Cash and previous generations of her extended clan. This album operates as a prodigious feat of travel reporting, historical investigation, and ways to make rock, folk, country, and blues work when you're a Manhattan woman maintaining connections to your roots. It's increasingly rare that a new musician comes along who can embody an older tradition, yet render a familiar form fresh. But 20-something Benjamin Booker did it with his debut blues rock funk album. He was at his best when he and his guitar sounded as though he was running down a dark street, chasing after something desirable or running from something frightening. It was the kind of year in which I was as happy to hear a bright bit of boy band punk rock like 5 Seconds of Summer's song She Looks So Perfect as I was Miranda Lambert's twang realism on a song like Bathroom Sink. If the year's best collection of old music was the long-awaited release of Bob Dylan's The Basement Tapes Complete, Dylan's current tour suggested that he continues to make the old stuff new. And as I consider my favorite music of the past year, making it new while being mindful of the past is the common theme, no matter how different the sounds are. Here's what I mean. 9 albums and a book that defined my year. Roseanne Cash's The River and the Thread, Pear Ubu's Carnival of Souls, Taylor Swift's 1989, Lana Del Rey's Ultraviolence, Miranda Lambert's Platinum, Spoon's They Want My Soul, X-Hex's Rips, Benjamin Booker's self-titled album, Jenny Lewis's The Voyager, and Viv Albertine's memoir, Clothes, 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 Music, 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 Boys, Boys, Boys. Happy New Year to you.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. Coming up, I discuss television in 2014 as we continue our year in review. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Fresh Air's TV critic, David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Last week, I sat down with Terry to talk about the year in television. Here's how it went.
Welcome back, David.
I love this.
So let's start with the big picture. Was this year a good year or a bad year for TV?
It was a good year for programming, not a great one in terms of the shows themselves, but in terms of what was happening on television, in terms of new and old formats and new exciting players coming into the mix. Another good year. I'm actually kind of encouraged.
Which is wonderful. The frustrating thing about it is that I just can't keep up.
Yeah. See ya and raise ya.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But that must be frustrating for you.
It is. Well, you know, television isn't even what it was when I started as a TV critic. It was a box in the living room. Now, you know, it's anything that comes in visually, regardless of where it comes in. It's sort of crazy. It's frustrating to me to try to be a professional and keep up with it all. But what's exciting is that, you know, something like WGN America or something like Amazon or a few years ago, FX, will try something when they weren't there before, and success breeds success. And we're in this wave of quality TV right now where people are betting on that.
Yeah. Well, so in this era of quality TV, what's on your top 10 list for the year?
Okay. I will go through this quickly and with apologies because it could be twice as long, but here they are. Should I do it reverse?
Sure, do it reverse. That build way, the suspense.
Yeah, build the suspense. Okay. Number 10, it's a tie between Louis on FX, which I love, and Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, a new show on HBO. And I think that he defined himself and that show so much in its first season that it deserves prominence.
Two of my favorite shows.
Okay. Number 9 is Homeland on Showtime, which I think bounced back this year after a bad previous season. Number 8, The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, always, I think, indispensable. Number 7, for the last time on my list, The Colbert Report.
And sob.
I know. Just it just went out, but we're going to see more of Colbert, and we'll talk about that, I'm sure, in a few minutes. Number 6, True Detective on HBO, which brought a new concentrated type of programming form that I'm very excited about and which, again, will be imitated. Number 5, Fargo on FX, the same thing. You know, self-contained stories that leave you in suspense because the characters don't have to live and you don't have to know what's going to happen. It goes all the way back to the old golden age of television where it was anthology shows and that suspense was built in. Number 4, The Roosevelts, An Intimate History on PBS. I think it was the best thing that Ken Burns has ever done and one of the trickier ones. Number 3, The Walking Dead on AMC. I know it's a genre show, but they're so intelligent about what they're doing with this. I really like that program. Number 2 is Justified, which is just about to come back for its final season. A lot of people – I think this is one of the most underrated shows on television, and it has one last chance to close its book and get some acclaim. And then number 1, it's a broadcast show. It's not cable. It's on CBS. It's The Good Wife.
You want to play a clip from it?
I would love to play a clip from it. And it's a clip that shows not only Juliana Margulies as the lead in terms of her strength, but also they have the deepest roster of really strong regulars and guest stars. Here you have David Hyde Pierce coming back to TV for the first time since leaving Frasier about a decade ago. And he's playing a media pundit who has thrown his hat into the ring for the same state's attorney's office that Alicia, the lead character played by Juliana Margulies, is playing. And in this clip, he shows up unannounced at her office with a taped-up shoebox.
Before James Castro left the race, he gave me this.
What is it?
It's dirt on you, your husband, your children, your family. I haven't opened it. He wanted me to use it against you, but I won't.
Why not?
I want to do this differently. I want to not pound you into submission, and I don't want you to pound me. I've heard politicians in the past agree they won't go negative, and they always go negative, and I think I know why.
Because it works?
No, because it's a posture. They don't mean it when they say it. Otherwise, they'd go to the other candidate, not the press. That's why I'm here. I'm not going to the press. I'm coming to you to say I will not go negative, and I'm asking you to do the same.
Now my campaign manager, if he were here, Frank, would say, you're up 3 points in the polls. Of course you want to suspend negative campaigning.
Yeah, but you must have the same projections I do. The race will tighten. You have women voters, I have African Americans, you have Catholics, I have limousine liberals. That's a flipped coin of a race. I like betting. I wouldn't bet on it. Wouldn't you rather win without bloodying each other in the process?
I don't have an opinion on that.
I doubt that.
That's your right.
Okay, that's a scene from The Good Wife, number one on our TV critic David Bianculli's top 10 list of TV shows of 2014. Good scene.
Yeah, no, it's so well acted and so well written. And what I love about the show is that everyone's motives are always suspect.
Yes. And, what is he covering up? I want to know.
Yeah, and everything shifts. It's such a good show.
Just one more thing about your top 10 list. You know, The Daily Show is on it, and there's a chance it won't be on it in 2016 because Jon Stewart's contract is up at the end of 2015, and who knows what he's going to do. It would be so sad to lose both The Colbert Report and The Daily Show.
I know. There's a big shift in terms of late night, and there are days where I watch those shows and I feel a little bit better for having seen them, not because they improve me as a person necessarily. It's just such a nice way to end the day, and it's what Carson was in the 70s. I remember that. It was nice to check in and see what Johnny Carson thought of the day in his monologue.
You're making me feel all warm about television, but you do have a worst list too. It's a short list because I think you wanted to highlight the very worst.
This is my favorite thing to do each year, is because I know you don't watch these. You have much too much sense. And if I just describe them, you might not even believe that they exist. but here are my two favorite worst from this year. The second worst, I think, they're both from Fox and they're both reality shows. One of them is I Want to Marry Harry, where they take women from the United States and send them over to England for like a dating reality show. But they get a lookalike to Prince Harry and they make these women think, and he tries to make them think, that that's who he is. And then eventually there's supposed to come this reveal where they find out he's not really a prince, but will true love work out in the end?
Is deception like that actually legal?
You know, this was in the tradition of something like Joe Millionaire, where he wasn't a millionaire, there is a tradition. It's just a sorry tradition. But
I thought that tradition was part of crime fiction, not reality television.
No, it's really bad. And I don't want to play a clip from that one because I've got a worse clip to play. This is a show called Utopia. And the idea here was to take, I think, 15 people from all different walks of life and put them in a place where they can create their own society. And, of course, Fox stacks the deck by making each one of these 15 people an uber stereotype. So there's like a toothless hillbilly, and there's a religious zealot, and there's a military vegan, and there's someone they describe as a polymorph. You know, it's just – oh my. So we do have a scene where the people from Utopia are gathering around this table in a barn with – laser images that are about to explain a year-long experiment they have just committed to.
Here we go.
Welcome to Utopia. You're here to create a new world. You have 1 year to do it. How you live is up to you. There are no laws here, no customs. What will you choose? Democracy or dictatorship? Fidelity or free love? Will you trade with the outside world or cut yourselves off? There are some things here to get you started. a barn for shelter, two cows, some chickens, 5 acres of fertile land, and a lake. There's a telephone and $5,000 in the safe. Will you spend it on construction materials, weapons, or farming equipment? Are toilets a priority?
So this was supposed to be an experiment that lasted a year.
A social experiment that lasted a year. It's so bad. And I Want to Marry Harry was so bad. Both of these shows were canceled almost instantly.
So is this unprecedented, or is this a sign of a new trend that reality shows don't have the staying power that they used to?
It's not unprecedented, but the fact that one of them, Utopia, they put so much money behind and so much hope behind, and it failed so miserably so quickly. It's better to bet on something original in terms of trying to get – look at the notice that Transparent got from Amazon. You know, bet on something unique or different rather than the 100th iteration of a stupid reality show.
More and more people are watching television through alternate means.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that Amazon has done in trying to create a niche for itself is to come up with a series that is unique. There's never before been a series about a character who comes out as a trans woman, as Jeffrey Tambor does on Transparent.
Right. You're absolutely right. It's what HBO did with Oz as a prison drama when it started getting into drama, saying, what hasn't been done on television before? How can we get some instant attention? It's hard to think of HBO as a brand new dramatic startup who wants attention, but that's what it did then, and that's one of the things that Amazon is doing now. But here you have this very sensitive subject, and if it were not treated properly, I think that Amazon would have been shot out of the water. But Jeffrey Tambor, his performance is so good. The writing is so interesting. And it takes several episodes to realize what's going on with the show.
So as we end 2014, the late night landscape is shifting again. Mm-hmm. What do we in store for in 2015?
Well, you know, we've just said goodbye to Stephen Colbert and to Craig Ferguson. So we're going to see Stephen Colbert as Stephen Colbert, not playing Stephen Colbert, which is very confusing. You know, that's unprecedented. I mean, it's not unprecedented to have somebody play a late night talk show host, because you have Martin Mull, you have Gary Shandling doing those things before. But they've never then gone on to do one as themselves, and they weren't playing themselves the first time. This has never been done. And some people are already speculating that Stephen Colbert is going to fail and that it's foolish for him to walk away from his alter ego. My bet is that he's going to do great.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
And Larry Wilmore is going to have a new show on Comedy Central.
And he's going to do – he's one of my favorite, you know, guys from The Daily Show. And that's another win-win. And even James Corden, who's coming over to take over Craig, is an interesting choice. So I think the next level of them, the next level of talk shows, it's going to be very interesting to watch in 2015.
What are some of the other programs you're looking forward to next year?
One big thing is I've been talking about this for so many years that I ought to get a piece of this. But Neil Patrick Harris is going to do a variety show. And it's based on a British show that I haven't seen, so I don't know the format. But I really have been saying for years that you know, somebody ought
I'm a witness.
Yeah, somebody ought to give this guy a variety show. Well, he's getting one, and it's on NBC. And if anybody can bring – for variety shows, if they get to come back – you know, we've just had anthologies come back with shows like Fargo and True Detective. So if the variety show comes back – I'll be a happy guy. I may be able to retire peacefully.
What else are you looking forward to?
We have Twin Peaks is coming back.
Really?
Yes. Twin Peaks is going to be coming back. And it's very weird because remember those scenes in the red room with the dancing little person?
Uh-huh.
Well, those were supposed to be set 25 years in the future. It's now 25 years in the future. And I don't know whether this is going to be horrible or wonderful, but we're still calling something like Twin Peaks. Nothing like Twin Peaks has ever shown up since. I'm very curious about that.
Does David Lynch, who directed the movie, it's that the TV series was based on, does he have anything to do with it?
Oh, yes. It's David Lynch and I think Mark Frost. It's those guys again.
Okay.
But still, it doesn't, you know. I remember there was a sketch on doing The Graduate Part 2. Well, it was in the movie The Player, you know, where just because you have an idea doesn't mean you should do it.
Do you have a favorite TV moment of 2014?
I have two favorite TV moments of 2014. One may not work as well on the radio, so I'll just describe it. And if people have seen this, I hope that they will be nodding with me. It's an episode from this season's Louis on FX. And Louis C.K. is dating a woman from Hungary. She speaks no English. He doesn't speak her language. But they're sort of feeling each other out. They're living in the same apartment building. And he's walking his daughter home from a music lesson, and they connect, and she runs back in. The Hungarian woman comes out with her own violin, and the two of them play this duet.
The daughter and
Louis' girlfriend.
Woman, yeah.
And it's gorgeous, and it's wordless, and it's a sort of communication that Louis hasn't been able to manage. And it was just a hauntingly beautiful piece of music, visual scene. I just loved it. It's unlike anything else I saw on TV that year. And then the other favorite moment, which I can play for you. As a matter of fact, I've played this once this year on Fresh Air when I was doing a review of the Graham Norton show. It's a talk show where Graham Norton, this British guy, it's on BBC America, is interviewing a singer named Robbie Williams. And he's asking him about the birth of his daughter. And Emma Thompson is one of the other guests, and she takes over the questioning. And so it doesn't take long, but it's just you hear Graham Norton laughing as loud as I've ever heard any TV show host laugh in response to the question.
Here we go.
Was Teddy born here?
Yes, she was born here, yeah.
Were you actually at the Hello Teddy moment? Were you there for the birth?
Yes, I was.
You were down the business end?
Yeah, I was.
Well done, man.
It was like my favourite pub burning down.
So that was a scene from the Graham Norton show.
Yeah, and I haven't been able to forget that scene. When I watched it, I couldn't believe that he said what he said. And luckily, I was able to rewind and listen to it again. And then it just got funnier and funnier to me that you would say that sort of thing. And I realized there's not a lot of talk in talk shows. And so I'm hoping for more of that in 2015.
Well, David, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much for being with us today. I want to wish you happy holidays, a great new year, and I look forward to hearing more of your thoughts on television in the year to come.
Thanks so much. I love these debriefings. Thank you, Terry.